entitled his talk, Where Do We Go From Here? Did I get that right, Brother Ken?
Generally.
Okay, Where Do We Go From Here? So we're looking forward to Brother Ken's service, and we'll turn the balance of time over to Brother Ken. Thank you.
Thank you, Brother Randall. And a handout is being passed out to all of you. I guess we could qualify the topic a little more and say, prophetically, where do we go from here? First of all, I just want to say that it is a real joy for Sister Virginia and I to be with you here at convention. You know, we've always looked upon the Connellsville Convention as an oasis where we get refreshed and supplied for the rigors of the warfare when we leave. We bring the warm Christian love and greetings of your brethren in New Brunswick, those that aren't here, especially from Brother Mike and Sister Rochelle Callanan. Sister Rochelle fell and dislocated her shoulder a while back, and she has not recovered enough to be able to travel. And from the Lollies, Sister Bev and Brother Dick intended, and we're looking forward very much to being here with you and enjoying the blessings of the convention. But Dick got sick, and he felt a little too weak to make this drive. You know, mentally, I flew into the... Oh, first, before I say that, I just want to... I appreciate very much the prayers of all of you last evening who knew of my problem. And that was very dear to my heart. So as I was saying, mentally I flew into the 20th century, but some of my practices are still carryover for 21st century, but some of my practices are still carryover from the 20th century, as you can see here. Maybe I'll catch up. Maybe I won't. Last Saturday, I conducted an all-day seminar on the current events and then also on Israel. So I decided to use some of that material and the transparencies I prepared for last Saturday here at Connellsville, so bear with me. You know, the attacks on the World Trade Center and Pentagon have thrust America into a new and seemingly ominous world, one that is less safe than ever before. An economic depression is looming. More terrorism is predicted, which might include biological, and we see it already, chemical, and perhaps nuclear terrorism. Violence is bound to increase with a corresponding effect on our economy. And it has well been said that probably life will never be the same in the United States. First, we're going to deal with several options of how the Islamic war or several options of how the Islamic war could affect the United States and Christendom, United States being a part of Christendom. Then we will consider what will yet happen in Israel. Now, many have warned of the rise of the Islamic threat. Those of you who were on our mission of comfort to Israel back in 92, remember Colonel Levy, the president and publisher of the Jerusalem Post, and as he spoke to us, he says, our battle with the Palestinians is not a battle over land. It is a war of religion. Islam against Judaism and Christianity. And then we all crowded into the small synagogue of Rabbi Kahane in, of all places, the Muslim section of the old city. And he read from past century scholars of Judaism the warning of, in the last days, there would come the great Islamic threat. And then in the 1996 mission of Comfort to Israel, we had the privilege of sharing the platform with Nadia Matar, and she introduced us to a PLO flag. This is a regular PLO flag, but it has wording in Arabic. And you know, this flag, just like this, with the wording in Arabic, was over a podium, and Archbishop Tutu of South America, or rather South Africa, who is very anti-Israel and very pro-Palestinian, was addressing a group of Palestinians. And he is standing under this flag, and he couldn't read the writing. And all through his lecture, he was hearing snickers. The audience was snickering. He couldn't figure it out. What's going on here? Well, as many of you know, the Arabic says, first the Saturday people, then the Sunday people. Again, among fundamentalist Islamic people, there is a threat, a desire to reconquer the world for Islam.
All it takes is sheer force and awkwardness.
This is a printout of a short, I don't know if you have the Osborne report in this part of the world or elsewhere in the country where some of you are from, but he deals with current events. And in this particular current event, he dealt with the Islamic threat. And he quoted from a noted authority on Islam and terrorism who had recently written a book. And this individual said that back in 1999, Bin Laden declared World War III.
Actually, back in 1999, as I was going over the internet,
I picked up this article about Bin Laden at that time declaring World War III on not just the United States, but the United States and Israel. And he said that he would terrorize the United States by bombing their commercial centers, shanghaiing their airplanes, and the implication that he would use these. And the purpose of this terrorizing was to get the United States to react and viciously bomb Afghanistan or wherever he was. And he figured on this vicious reaction of the United States bombing Muslims would push the moderate Muslims into his more radical camp. Well, there's a lot of predictions about how long or how short this war will be and what it will extend to. We have experienced anthrax in this country. The prediction is that there could very well be terrorism with smallpox. And then it says that tens of millions would die throughout the world if terrorism ever started using smallpox. Now, George Bush, President George Bush, in his address to the nation right after the declaration of war, spoke of a fringe form of Islamic extremism rejected by the majority, the vast majority of Islamic clerics and people. But you know, throughout the world, it's hard to come by an Islamic leader that has spoken out in agreement with Bush. In fact, I could show you article after article where it shows that the vast majority of the Muslim population throughout the world are in sympathy with Bin Laden and not in sympathy with the United States attacks on Afghanistan. Well, just where does the Muslim act and possible threat to the world, where does it fit into prophecy? Does it fit into prophecy? Of course, I'm sure there's going to be a flurry of investigation of prophecy now to see if we can come up with prophecies that have the Muslims in it. But, you know, we have to keep focused. the main events of the time of trouble involve Christendom and a yet brief rise of power of Christendom and then its complete collapse. And some feel that the Islamic forces will bring about that complete collapse. We'll make two suggestions as how the Muslims and the Islamic forces could fit into this prophetic picture about Christendom. Now, in Volume 4, Little Russell observed that part of the time of trouble is a conflict between the has and the have-nots, and that takes place in many different areas, in society, between the wealthy and those that are in poverty, between nations that are in great wealth and nations that are in poverty. In the present U.S. and Western European war against the Islamic fundamentalists is a war between haves and have-nots. The vast majority of the Muslims, despite the fact that there are some very rich oil Muslim countries, the vast majority of the Muslims live in poverty on a worldwide basis. You know, the Islamic Empire, in its heyday, was the largest empire in history. And they are the representatives of God, they feel. And what's happened to them? They have deteriorated so low on the scale. And the United States is a great superpower that advocates all of the Satan's immorality, according to the Islam. The Christian nations are the haves in this war, and the Islamic nations are the have-nots. Now, there's a second area where the Islam might come into focus. Now, Brother Russell, in the fourth volume, spoke of the scripture, and I think it's Ezekiel 7:24, the worst of the heathen. And he gave two applications. He says that possibly it could refer to heathen nations from the east. That's a possibility, but his more defined application was that the worst of the heathens would be those who once claimed to be Christians within Christianity and then gave up their beliefs. And when Christianity was in power in the church-state system, they would rise up and be a revolutionary and an anarchy force that would overthrow Christendom, and this would be the ultimate destruction of Christendom. Well, it's possible that the Lord might use the Islamic forces to weaken Christendom to the point that both government and the people would feel the need of bringing the church into the government and have a church-state system to bring order out of the distressing conditions at that time. Or it might be possible that you might have a church-state system formed in the near future and that an Islamic war could weaken the Christian church-state system to the point that the forces from within, the Lord's great army from within, could tear it down. We're just suggesting these as possibilities. Certainly, as far as their operation, their viciousness, their vengefulness, the Muslim armies could qualify as the worst of the heathen. You know what the Taliban do when they take prisoners? If you weren't in an actual battle with them, you're taken as a live prisoner. But if they catch you, if they capture you in an actual battle, they stake you down in the desert, split you open, and let the sun beat down on you, and the death will take about 48 hours. Certainly they could be considered qualified as the worst of the heathen if the Lord's purpose is that way. Well, will there be a worldwide Islamic war? I don't know. I don't know how this war will last. But this I do know. The main purpose of the time of trouble is the destruction of Babylon. during which Christendom will have a temporary rise to power and then be destroyed by revolution and anarchy from within. Now, as we said, it might be that the Lord will use Islam to weaken the nations to permit this further destruction to take place from within. How long before the deliverance of the church? This war could lead into a scenario very quickly in which the Babylon would come to power, and you would have the fulfillment of prophecy of after that rise to power, the church is giving a message, and then the deliverance of the church, and then the rising up of the masses and the destruction of the church. But all of this is according to the Lord's timing. It depends how far we are according to His time clock, not according to our time clock. I think of the many times that the Lord's people have been disappointed by delays. I think of World War II. Boy, it had to be then. I think of the Israel becoming a nation in 1948, though the brethren thought, that's it. We're going to have Gog and Magog, and that's it, all over. Then we had 1954, 1958, 1980, 1994, 1998. But we're all here yet. So it depends on the Lord's time clock. Well, how do we prepare for a future persecution if the church, the nominal systems, come to power? Oftentimes, the wonderful example of our European brethren is set before us, and rightly so. So we should be prepared to endure what they endured. Well, how did they prepare? Did they know there was going to be a great persecution that they were going to be victimized by? You know, there were many heroes among the brethren then. And there were some that failed. Why did some come off victoriously? And why did others fail? How do we prepare ourselves for a future persecution? A very simple principle. He that is faithful in little will be faithful in much. I don't care what your occupation is. Computer wizard, on the assembly line, a housewife washing dishes. But if we are faithful day in and day out, obeying the Lord's will for us in little things, what's happening? Something is being crystallized in our hearts, a desire to do His will, whatever it is. So that when the great persecutions or the greater tests come upon us, those that have been faithful in obeying the Lord in little things will probably be faithful then. Those that have not been faithful in obeying the Lord's will in the little affairs of daily life probably will not be victorious at that time. Now, Israel. Brother Randall or Dwayne or Wes or whoever, could I have a glass of water up here, please? Thank you. Now, Sharon has been a hardliner, a right-winger, for a long time. He was swept into the office by the election on the fact that he was going to be very hardline in his treatment of the Palestinians in the pursuit of peace. He right away formed a unity government and brought all the peace lovers, the Peace Now people, and Doves into his government, the Labor Party. And he said, well, he needed this unity government because he was sure war was coming, and he wanted to have unity in the nation in entering this war. You know, just the 15th of this month, Sharon had a meeting with a family that had one of their members killed by a terrorist. And he said, quote, He knows that in the end there will have to be a no-choice war, but that he, as prime minister, must determine the right timing, unquote. In other words, the right-wingers aren't going to tell him what to do. He's going to choose the time when that will take place. Well, is he sticking to that? It's hard to say. How is Bush's endeavor to convince the Arab nations to join his coalition against bin Laden, how is this affecting Bush's pressure on Israel, and how successful is it? Thank you very much, Wes. Well, since Bush has been putting on the pressure, seemingly Sharon is waffling on his hardline stand. Sharon has come out, committed himself to a Palestinian state with a number of conditions, one of which violence has to be completely stopped and the terrorist arrested or turned over to Israel. Well, some feel that he's made this a commitment with these strong conditions, knowing that the PLO would not keep these conditions. Well, we don't know. 61% of the Israelis are in favor. This is a report in the Jerusalem Post. 61% of the Israelis are in favor of a Palestinian state. Now, why are they in favor? 61% of the Israeli public in favor of a Palestinian state. Because they don't have the faith that the Lord can deliver them in this situation? Well, that's part of it, but there's more to it than that. The demographic problem. You know, the Palestinians multiply so fast, you have two wives, 14 children with each wife. That's a lot of children. And the population increase of the Palestinians is phenomenal. From the Mediterranean Sea to the Jordan River, just this year, within the last several months, the Palestinian population in this area, from the shore of the Mediterranean Sea to the Jordan River, is equal to the Jewish population in that area. That's a combination of the West Bank and Israel proper. Of course, in the West Bank, the Palestinians far excel the Jewish settlers in population. In the West Bank, or rather in Israel proper, the Jews are more numerous, greater population than the Arabs. But by 2020, within Israel proper, the Arabs will be equal in number with the Jewish people on the basis of natural growth. Well, there's several solutions to this. You've heard of the assassination of Gandhi, a cabinet member, recently. I was very saddened by that assassination for two reasons. Gandhi was a true Bible-believing Zionist. And he had a solution. He uses the word transfer, I'll say, just move all the Palestinians out of this whole area into the surrounding Arab countries. He'd pay them for going. He'd buy their property. There's another reason I'm disappointed by his assassination, not just the tragic death. I was looking forward to having a meeting with him when we go to Israel in November. Well, the real solution, as we'll get on in our further discussion of Scripture, is the mass migration of Jews. You know, there's over 5 million in the United States and over 3 million left in Russia. Now, what are the PLO intentions? Are they satisfied with just having an independent state in the West Bank and Gaza? No. You know, the PLO has published a number of maps of the Middle East, and on every single map that they have published, there's no name Israel here, and there's no West Bank. This whole area is called Palestine. They're not satisfied with just getting the West Bank, but they envision getting all of the land of Israel. You know, it's incredible, but United States envoys meet Arafat in his office. He's on that side of the desk in front of a wall that has a big map on it, Palestine across the whole land of Israel, and U.S. envoys sit there, they talk with them, and they never mention it. Why do the news media, the heads of the Western powers, even in the United States and in Europe, why do they speak of the Israelis as being the terrorists? And why do they speak of the Palestinians as being the freedom fighters? Well, the UN has passed many resolutions against Israel. Possessing occupied territory. Israel is occupying foreign territory. They say this territory belongs to the Palestinians rightly. You know, in 1974, Arafat walks into the General Assembly at the UN with gun holsters. He comes swaggering in with gun holsters on each hip to a rousing standing ovation. And he says, the Zionist invasion began in 1881 when Palestine was a verdant area and a dynamic culture that extended back for centuries was dynamically progressing forward. A verdant area? A dynamic culture of Palestinians who had roots for centuries and centuries? Certainly the Bible teaches otherwise. But history also teaches otherwise. The Jewish people was a thriving nation for 1,700 years. Then there was a forced exile and invasions by Persians, Arabs, and I don't mean Persians in connection with the ancient powers, but post-AD. Invasions by Persians, Arabs, Mamluks, and Turkeys devastated the Holy Land. But some Jews clung to their land. You know, there are certain areas in the land of Israel, Hebron notably, and Safad in the Galilee area, where with very little exception, Jews have dwelt for 3,600 years. In the 1970s and or in the 1700s and the 1800s, Palestine was not a verdant area. It was a desolate area. And travelers who traveled in Palestine in the 1600s, the 1700s, the 1800s, they all testified that this land was desolate, hardly any population. Finn, who was the British Consul General in Jerusalem, wrote, I think it was about 1850, that the land is a barren waste. Its greatest need is a body of population. Oh, I thought it was thriving with a dynamic Arab culture that had lasted for centuries. Finn says that its greatest need was a body of population. He said this in 1850. This is the most thrilling thing. Why? because the Lord prophesied that the land would be desolate of man and beast. That is, relatively desolate of man and beast during the period of Israel's double punishment. And Israel's double punishment ended in 1878. And the body of population that the land was just waiting for and crying for came with the influx of Jewish immigrants. Well, where did the Palestinians come from? Well, you can quote many historians, and even Prime Minister MacDonald of Great Britain and President Franklin Roosevelt observed that first you had the Jewish immigration, and because of the great influx of money from worldwide Jewish drives to build a superstructure for our nation, that Arabs began to just flood into the area to take advantage of the new economy there and the abundance of employment. You know, right now, Israel has turned over their land, 40% of their land in the West Bank, to the Palestinians. The Palestinians now have 40% of the West Bank. And 98% of the Palestinians on the West Bank live in this 40% area, live under Palestinian autonomy. We're going to run through some slide to show a brief history of the development of the land by the Zionists. In 1917, the Balfour Declaration to promise a Jewish state in the land, and this Jewish state this whole area here was to be the new Jewish state. Not this area that you have here. But in 1920, the League of Nations supported the Balfour Declaration, and they appointed Britain as the mandate power to prepare this whole area there for a new Jewish state. But something happened very quickly. Winston Churchill speaks of a quiet Sunday afternoon when he created the Arab Emirate of Transjordan. Well, I'm foolish for taking this time because I won't get to the end of my talk, but we'll take the time. It's an interesting bit of history. How did it come that the land got, three-quarters of the land got chopped off and Israel just had the remaining quarter? Well, Great Britain had promised Hussein, who was the ruler of the Arabian Peninsula at that time, that if his son Faisal led a Arab legion to help the Allied effort, and believe me, they were more of a hindrance than a help, that they would get a territory, and this is what Hussein asked for, a greater Syria that would include Syria, Jordan, Lebanon, and what we call the land of Israel. Then when the Balfour Declaration came out, Faisal went running up to Lloyd George and said, "What are you doing here? You promised us this land as a part of the greater Syria." So Lloyd George says, "Well, go see Chaim Weizmann." So Faisal got together with Chaim Weizmann, who was a great leader, a Zionist leader at that time, and he actually saved the British war effort by synthesizing acetone, which is necessary for the making of munitions at that time. He was a great chemist as well. And, you know, Faisal and Weissman just clicked. And they agreed that they're both sons of Abraham. They can get together and live together in this greater this area of greater Syria, and that this area here would become independent for Jewish immigration. Well, then the French got into the picture. They said to Great Britain, you know, why are you controlling all of this area here and deciding what's going to be done here? We want a piece of the pie. So Britain said, okay, we'll give you Syria to have control over and decide the future of Syria. Well, what's that going to do? Faisal was promised a rulership over greater Syria. So he marched into Damascus in 1921 with an army, and he declared Syria his. But France gave him the boot. So Britain gave him a consolation prize and said, okay, you can have Iraq, Faisal, and be the king of Iraq. But that was the problem. Because in the British agreement, Faisal was to have the greater Syria, and Faisal's younger brother, Abdullah, was to be king of Iraq. So now Faisal's made king of Iraq, and here, down here in Medina, Abdullah is sulking away. So it's a very humorous story how he finally got to Amman with a ragtag army of 2,000. But they got off a train that they shanghaied and took to Amman. And a British sergeant came running out to see what's all this commotion. I mean, they never saw a train come in this station for months. And Abdullah got off and he says, I declare all of this area as under my sovereignty, and I will be king. So the British sergeant sort of smiled. And he said, I have to see my commanding officer, which was a colonel. The colonel sent a telegram to the secretary or minister of colonialism, who happened to be young Winston Churchill at that time. And Churchill started laughing. He says, no, there's this clown, who does he think he is? But then a light bulb went on in his mind. He said, we need a standing army in the Middle East to guard our interests, particularly the Suez Canal and other interests that will develop now that the Turks do not have control of that area. So I wired back the colonel. He says, tell Abdullah that we will make him ruler over Transjordan if he lets British officers train his army and lead his army. In the 47 war, Transjordan was the only Arab nation that made any progress in that war, and they were led by British officers. Now we come to the partition plan. In Israel, in the Balfour Declaration, and the League of the Nations mandate were promised this much land. We're now to have the white area, and a new Arab state would be set up. So Israel had no choice. They accepted that. They declared themselves an independent state, and you know the story. There was a war. Six Arab nations marched in, and Israel took this much of the territory. What is now the so-called West Bank was a part of Transjordan, which changed its name to Jordan. They were now on both sides of the Jordan River. And then there was the 67 war, and Israel took not only the West Bank and the Golan Heights, but they also took all of the Sinai, and they eventually gave back the Sinai, and they ended up with what we saw earlier, their current boundaries. Now, we'll get to our handout. And we tried to list a sequence of events. We're not dogmatic about the sequence of events. It will be from the 67 war to the mediatorial reign. But it's just a suggestion for your prophetic vision and study. First, there was the capture of East Jerusalem. East Jerusalem is the old city that is walled, plus the city of David. And the rest of Jerusalem, which is called the New City of Jerusalem, was built up after 48 mainly, and somewhat a little before 48. Now, the first population census taken in Jerusalem was in 1843, I believe, was the year. And it found that the Jews and not the Arabs were the largest, have the largest population in Old Jerusalem, the Bible Jerusalem. And ever since, the Jews have been a majority in the Bible Jerusalem. Here's a picture of the Bible Jerusalem, Old Jerusalem, before the 48 War of Independence, when Jordan captured Old Jerusalem. That's a picture of the Jordanian occupation, and actually you can't see it very well. The reason is everything's devastated. All the synagogues have been bulldozed. Actually, Jordan bulldozed all evidence of Jewish history in the old Jewish quarter. And then in the 67 war, of course, Israel got... That's a very poor, sorry about that. The old city back, and they have rebuilt it beautifully. Now, there are three organizations that are buying up property in the within the walled city of Jerusalem. Now, the British in 1936 divided it into four areas. The Jewish, you know, they say it's quarters, but the Jewish quarter was the smallest quarter. How you get four unequal areas when you divide it into quarters is something else again. But the Muslim section and the Christian section, which is actually occupied predominantly by Arabs, were the larger sections. And I walked through. Yeah, we'll just put that on briefly. I walked through the Muslim section, the Christian section, and you'll find house after house after house that is occupied by Arabs that have the hole where the Jewish mezuzah was. They ripped it out and they either left it vacant or else they tried to plaster a cement over it to lose its identity, but you still saw that shape there. Hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of homes, thousands of homes in this whole area had evidence that they were formerly occupied by Jews. Well, now, three Jewish organizations are buying up these homes. They're paying exorbitant prices, maybe a $500,000 or even $1 million. For one home. Money is donated from Jews throughout the world for this work. And Going back to this one. In the city of David, I am told, I can't prove it, that 50 to 70% of the Arab homes in the city of David had been bought and up. And at the appropriate time, all of a sudden, you'll see a mass exodus of Arabs from the city of David, and these homes will be taken over by Jewish inhabitants. One more map on Jerusalem. This was this blue line was the Jerusalem that was occupied after the 48 war into 1967. The black line designates Jerusalem after 1967, when Israel captured the old city of Jerusalem. And then they extended their boundaries to this wide area. But I want to bring your attention into the core of Bible Jerusalem, Eastern Jerusalem, is outlined here. You see this red blotch here? This is what is called Zone B. Zone B is administered civilly by the PLO, but under Israeli military security. This Zone B at this point, Abu Dis, which you've heard about in the news, extends into the old city of Jerusalem. Why? Because that great rightist, Bibi Netanyahu, during his administration, was already preparing for the division of Jerusalem and preparing for a capital of the Palestinians in Jerusalem. And he had Abu Dis extended into Old Jerusalem, and they have built a parliamentary building that extends into Old Jerusalem that will become their capital, they hope, in a future negotiation. This map is predicated upon Israel giving up all of the West Bank in a future peace agreement. And if that is true, the Palestinians with rockets will be able to hit all the major areas. Now here, 70% of the Jewish population in this narrow strip live, and 80% of the industrial base of Israel's in this area. These rockets could actually hit anything in that narrow strip. And the PLO has had meetings with Egypt, Syria, Jordan on the role that the PLO would play in a future Arab-Israel war. And that role would be basically this. You know, Israel does not have a large standing army. They have to mobilize their army, and it takes 48 hours to mobilize it. The PLO's role in a future Israeli-Arab war would be to actually bomb out all of the main roads that the Israeli reservists would have to take to get to their units in a mobilization, as well as carry on a fifth column terrorist destruction. Okay, now we've lost the battle of time. I gave you the whole handout, not with the hope of covering it, but something that you can study and consider at your home. All right, we'll try to go through as far as we can in the remaining time. This division of Jerusalem or rather the capture of the Bible Jerusalem was shown in Zechariah, the 12th chapter, verses 2, 5, and 6. In verse 2, it speaks of a war that Israel would have with the people round about, and the people round about are the Arab nations, and in this war, they would capture Jerusalem. And the actual battle for the Jerusalem is shown in verses 5 and 6 of Zechariah 12, and it says that Jerusalem would occupy its own place even in Jerusalem. At the end of the 48 War of Independence, Jordan occupied the Bible Jerusalem. So the Israelis declared the new city of Jerusalem to be their capital. But they knew deep in their hearts that the real capital was occupied by Jordan. In the 67 War, Jerusalem, the capital of Israel, occupied its own place, even in Jerusalem, the Bible Jerusalem, a remarkable fulfillment of prophecy. Our next item on the handout deals with immigration. you know, Bible students back in Brother Russell's time were expecting a great immigration of Jews from Russia, immigration from the north. Jeremiah 3, verse 12, speaks about the Jews in the north land, which we feel is Russia. And then verse 14 says that the Lord would gather one out of a family and one out of a city. This is what I call a trickle, a small flow of immigration into Israel. But then in Isaiah 27:12, it speaks of their being gathered one by one. And then it speaks of the trumpet sounding. And as a result of the trumpet sounding, there would be a great exodus of the Jews from Assyria and from Egypt. Well, of course, the trumpet sounded in Russia long before 1990. It was probably part of the trumpet sound that brought about the revolution back in the early 1900s. But the Jews did not have any civil liberties in Russia. They did not have the right to immigrate to Israel. There was such world pressure put on Russia to let the Jews immigrate and to give civil rights to the people, and finally Russia gave in. Communism fell. People marched. That was a jubilee trumpet. They demanded their rights. And the communist empire fell to pieces in days. Unbelievable. It was a jubilee trumpet sounding again. And the Jews were given, for the first time, Russian Jews were given the right to immigrate to Israel. And they did. Over 1 million immigrated from 1991 to our day. And this was predicted in Isaiah 27:13, and then Jeremiah 16 speaks that the day is coming in which they no longer say that the Lord brought the children of Israel out of the land of Egypt, but the Lord liveth that brought the children of Israel out of the land of the north, out of the land of Russia. And that was a remarkable assimilation by Israel of over 1 million Jews. It would be equal to the United States in a 10-year period assimilating the total population of Russia, or rather, a total population of France, which we know the United States could never do. But Israel did it. Why? Because the Lord is with them. Then there's a peace process. And there might be temporary peace. They should say peace, peace, but sudden destruction will come eventually if there is a peace. And we feel that in the peace process, Israel will give up. They've already given up 40% of the West Bank. We feel that they will probably give up more, because in Obadiah 18 and 19, it speaks of Judah fighting and regaining Samaria and Judea, which is the proper name for the West Bank. So evidently, Israel will give up in the peace process at least a part of Judea and Samaria that will be regained by Israel in a future war. We feel that there will be a future war. And as a result of this future war, Israel will acquire any of the Golan they give up. They've given up some already under dear Kissinger's, who was a has Jewish heritage, but he certainly was willing to give up much land in Israel. He gave up part of the Golan to Syria. If they give up more, they will get it back in the future war. They'll get back the land of Gilead. They'll get back Ammon, Moab, and Edom. There are a number of scriptures on this. Isaiah 11:14 speaks of Israel having a war with on the west with the Philistines, and the west is the Gaza area, and the Philistines inhabited the Gaza area in Bible times, but now the Palestinians occupied, and they claim they're the old Philistines. Well, they'll get the reward of the old Philistines, and they'll be defeated by Israel. Then in Isaiah 11:14 it says that on the east they will have a war with Ammon, Moab, and Edom, and that they will, these countries will obey Israel. They'll get a decisive victory over these countries. So we feel that the future borders of Israel, before the time of trouble is over, will include what Ammon, Moab, and Edom represent, and Gilead, and that is the nation of Jordan, and the Golan, and then back in Obadiah, of the 20th verse, it speaks of Israel occupying all the way up to Zarephath in Lebanon. And this is before the time of trouble is over. Because in Micah the 7th chapter, verse 14, in a time of trouble setting, the verses before are speaking of a time of trouble, and the verses following verse 14 are speaking of a time of trouble, and it speaks of Israel dwelling in Bashan, which is the Golan Heights, and in Gilead, and in other places. And then in Zephaniah 2, we also have a war that Israel has with in the Gaza Strip area and defeats the Palestinians. And they have a war with Ammon and with Moab, and they defeat them and possess them. And our time is just about up. So, take this sequence of events with you. Study it. If you have any questions on it, then you see me at another convention, tap me on the shoulder and ask me about it. I just want to close with one scripture, and that's our last scripture, Isaiah 44:23. And this is a kingdom scene. Sing, O ye heavens, for the Lord hath done it. Shout, ye lower parts of the earth. Break forth into singing, ye mountains, O forest, and every tree thereof. For the Lord hath redeemed Jacob and glorified himself in Israel. Who are the heavens? This is the heavens of the third world. The Christ head and body. And here, the glorified Christ, the glorified church, will be singing and be filled with joy. Why? Because the Lord hath redeemed Jacob, and the Lord hath glorified himself in Israel. Brethren, rejoice in what's going on in Israel. Rejoice in prophecy being fulfilled. Rejoice in the fact that the Jews, the believing Jews, by the time the time of trouble is over, which I feel will be a majority, will be your earthly brethren, and you will be working with them in the ancient worthies, in the blessing of all mankind in the kingdom. God bless you all.